Welcome to China in Context. I'm Duncan Bartlett. The crew of a cargo ship called Rubimar endured a terrifying experience as they traversed the Red Sea in February. Their vessel was hit by two missiles fired by Houthi rebels. Fearing for their lives, 20 sailors abandoned ship, along with a group of four guards who were trying to protect them. The ship was unarmed. It was carrying fertilizer from the United Arab Emirates to Bulgaria. Even though China was not involved, as a maritime nation which depends on imports of oil, trouble in the Red Sea inevitably causes concern. And the violence is also a reminder of the vulnerable nature of global supply chains. On today's podcast, we'll be considering what China and other countries are doing to mitigate the risks. And I'm joined by Christopher S. Tang, a professor in business administration at the Anderson School of UCLA in California. Chris, welcome back to China in Context.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the story of this cargo ship, Rubimar. It was attacked by the Houthis, and they claim to be showing solidarity with the Palestinians. So they're targeting ships which they say are linked to Israel, or a British, or are American. Now, it turns out that the Rubimar was carrying about 20,000 tons of ammonium phosphate fertilizer from the United Arab Emirates to Bulgaria, and it had been chartered by a Saudi company. And when it sank, it left a big slick in the Red Sea because of the leaking fuel. The cargo also leaked out, and the shipwreck itself is a risk to all the other ships going through the busy shipping lanes on the waterway. It all sounds basically like a bit of a nightmare. How are the Chinese viewing the situation?
The situation is rather peculiar. At the start, I think the Houthis was thinking that they're going to attack ships that is related with Israel, United States, or the UK. But in the Rubimar situation, it has nothing to do with these three countries. And yet, they were under attack. So now, there are ships, they are being attacked indiscriminately. That really triggered a lot of concerns. Now, China, on the other hand, has been silent on these issues. China has not condemned the attack of Hamas attack in Israel, and China has not condemned about the Houthis attack in the Red Sea. And actually, today, we discovered there's some internet cables were cut near the Red Sea area. So this under investigation, whether it is cut by the Houthis or some other incidents occurred there. So initially, China thought that they would be safe to pass through the Red Sea. And yet, they were under a lot of pressure by the importers and by the shipping companies. As a result, over 100 container ships, they are actually bypassing the Red Sea. They have to go through the Cape of Good Hope, which takes much longer and much more expensive.
Well, that's a fascinating opening answer. Thanks very much, Chris. Now, I've been looking at a map of the region, and I noticed that China has a significant footprint there. Not only does it have its own military base in Djibouti, it's also invested tens of billions of dollars in port facilities, railways, factories, and other projects, partly financed through its Belt and Road Initiative. Can you tell us more about China's ports development under the BRI, and how does this fit in with the global picture?
This is a fascinating story. The Belt and Road Initiative, starting out in 2013 under President Xi, the idea is that to revitalize the Silk Road between China and the rest of the world, in particular with Africa and Europe. So as of now, there are estimations that China has invested over $1 trillion on these different projects. So the BRI initiative is really trying to connect China with other trading blocks in Africa, in Europe, through different means. First is really trying through the land ports to go through from China to maybe Middle Asia, to Russia, and then to Europe through railroads. The other one is a maritime Silk Road, is building ports. China actually has really a global presence of the control of many ports around the world.
Well, in normal times, the Red Sea routes account for about a third of all the global container traffic, particularly the trade between Asia and Europe. But as you said there, China and other countries are avoiding going through the Red Sea. They're going round South Africa, actually. And this is obviously pushing up the cost of sending goods around the world in container ships. What do you think is going to be the impact of these Houthi attacks in the Red Sea on ocean freight, which originates from China?
You are absolutely right. China actually rely on the Red Sea to through the Suez Canal to Europe. This accounts for around 30% of the container shipping lanes in the world. Now, because of the attacks in the Red Sea, China is going through the South Africa, going through the Cape of Good Hope. Now, that would take much longer. You're talking about 3,000 to 6,000 nautical miles, which would cause around 2 to 4 weeks of delay. Now, putting the delay aside, it also affects the capacity because the ship takes longer from the origin to the destination. So that means there are not that many ships to turn it around as quickly as possible. As a result, the cost of shipping has increased tremendously. The capacity has decreased as well.
Well, I want to ask you about a word which has become something of a cliche in recent years, nearshoring. This is based on the idea that countries concentrate on obtaining supplies from nations which are friendly and are nearby, hence the nearshoring phrase. What does this nearshoring trend mean for China?
This is a rather peculiar word. So let's take a step back. After the COVID really stoked fear among the American public because of product shortages. So at that time, after President Trump and also President Biden, they were pushing, typically using the word decoupling. So they said that we can no longer rely on China to produce products for the American consumers. But then they realized that decoupling is not possible because 50% of the electric vehicles are made in China, 70% of the EV batteries are made in China, 90% of the solar panels are also made in China. Now, during the pandemic, even our COVID tests hit, they're all made in China. So that really triggered the fact that is we cannot be completely decoupled from China. Therefore, the politician changed the name from decoupling to de-risking. But then what does it mean? That means that they thought that to try to lower the risk by diversifying the supply chain to actually to source from other countries, such as Vietnam and Mexico. So nearshoring is the term that tries to source more from Mexico because that you have more options for transportation. You can ship it by sea through the Gulf, you can ship it by land through the rail, or you can ship it by trucks. That is perceived to be safer and more resilient supply chain. That is part of the initiative of the nearshoring.
Well, thanks for that very clear explanation. Now, as you said, another word which is often used in regard to these issues these days is de-risking. Can I share with you a quote from William Burns, the director of the CIA? He's argued that for the US, the answer is not to decouple from an economy like China's, which would be foolish, but to sensibly de-risk and diversify by securing resilient supply chains, protecting America's technological edge, and investing in industrial capacity. What do you make of that quote?
That is an interesting quote, indeed. Well, as I said before, actually, China is the factory of the world. Decoupling is not possible. Besides, many American companies are selling American brand products in China. Because relying on United States and Europe, there is very little growth. So they were counting on China with 1.4 billion people who would buy the American products so that we can get the economy going. So it has worked to a certain extent. So therefore, decoupling is not a viable option. Now, de-risking. De-risking is also not risk-free. So a lot of people thought of, oh, de-risking, that means you lower the risk. But they actually increase other types of risk. Yes, you can diversify your supply base from other countries. But one, it would make the supply chains much more complex. Now, if you don't have a complete supply chain transparency or supply chain visibility, by making your supply chains even more diversified, it would actually, you lose the control of the entire supply chain. If something goes wrong, how do you do track and trace? It's become questionable. Second, if you keep on siphoning or shifting away from China, China may actually retaliate the American product, which we'll see. So right now, GM, Shanghai, the cars are not selling that well. And Apple, iPhone, and the Chinese government officials are discouraged to buy the iPhone. So as a result, actually using this term without really being diplomatic, it will actually create major problems.
Now, you're teaching at business schools. Can you share with us how you frame discussions on these global supply chain issues with your students?
So usually I would say that this decoupling is not a viable option. And actually, without including China in the equation, it is not a smart idea. So I think that situations is still rather fluid, but I think that it's better to keep at least one foot in China and try to see if you can cultivate and strengthen the tie in terms of economic ties. No countries can survive without trade, and China is the second largest economy in the world, and actually is still one of the largest trading partner with the US. So in terms of sourcing from China, it makes sense for United States to develop the in-house capability for critical product as what President Biden is trying to do. So certain products should be made in the US to make sure that we have this supply. But then the question is how to make it happen. I think that the government can partner with universities and companies to develop an industry policy, to develop some capability to do research and development in key areas, which they are trying to do in the semiconductor industry, because this is very critical. Pharmaceutical companies, I think that now more firms is going to produce the drugs in the United States. So I think that this is really the key area we should focus on. But for other areas, it is not practical and also not economical to cut China out of the equation.
Well, thank you, Chris. We've covered a wide range of subjects in today's podcast, and you've responded to some quite tricky questions with nuanced and thoughtful answers. That's Christopher S. Tang, a professor in business administration at the Anderson School of UCLA in California. This podcast is produced by the SOAS China Institute, part of the University of London, and you can find out more about our courses and research at soas.ac.uk. But for now, that's all from us here at the China in Context podcast team.